Welcome to Outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. And this evening, we're lucky to have a guest, Colorado State Representative Leslie Herod. In 2016, Representative Herod became the first African-American LGBT person elected to the Colorado State House of Representatives. She's shepherded through over 68 bills to the governor's desk for final signature. She's in many leadership positions, particularly in the purse strings in Colorado, which is a very powerful position to be in. Chairing appropriations on the Committee of Legal Issues, School Finance, and the very powerful JBC, the Joint Budget Committee, which is kind of the final spot where bills live or die based on money. She's a member of the Democratic Black Caucus, involved in other committees and many other memberships. In this session, she's been a prime sponsor for over 10 bills originating in the House, including areas as disparate as college athletics, small business and arts funding, outdoor equity, and improving the criminal justice system, which we're going to focus a bit on in the show today. Improving things in juvenile court, the DMV, body cameras, ketamine use, and much more. Could you reflect for us, what were some of your highs in the legislative session this last time, and maybe a low?
First, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate being able to come on your show. You know, for me, this was a really tough legislative session, particularly around just like the increase in racism and vitriol that a lot of us as BIPOC people, but specifically Black folks, were feeling in the legislature, but also in the community. You know, there was a real backlash this year against the summer of racial reckoning and this, you know, conversation around how we can do better when it comes to issues of race in this country. And while I know we have made such tremendous progress, it has come at a cost. You know, we have had a lot of attacks against our persons as Black women, particularly. But that doesn't stop us from doing the work. And so some of my really, I think, great highlights were clearly being able to move forward on police accountability once again and pass House Bill 1250 that has been used days after the bill was signed into law, specifically around the release of body cam footage and the requirement not to tamper with that footage, but additionally around law enforcement accountability as a whole. On top of that, though, I think I'm really excited about the work that we've been able to do when it comes to COVID recovery and looking at the state budget from an equity lens and really thinking about who is having or who needs the most support when it comes to our recovery efforts and how can we make sure that our funding and our resources go in that direction. That's why I passed a bill related to small business relief, as well as arts relief, because we realized that the artists weren't getting any direct funding through the COVID Relief Act. And so, you know, there was a lot of different bills that I was able to work on that I'm really proud of. And I think overall, just being able to navigate this really tough session with COVID, with the recovery, and also with kind of this racism that was swelling up, I think that's what I'm really proud of being able to do. Additionally, though, I will say that we had been able to, as an LGBTQ caucus, really send off fights against transgender people, which has just been popping back up across this country in ways that are definitely coordinated and extremely hurtful and hateful. And so being able to work with my colleagues in the LGBTQ caucus, specifically our first transgender lawmaker, Breonna Taupone, we were able to fight against those attacks and ensure that we continue to make progress on our issue.
I think it's so important for Coloradoans to realize how damaging the racism as well as the transphobia that comes across the nation, how poisoning it is to people to live in that continual rhetoric floating around our country.
Absolutely, absolutely. While I'm glad we have a progressive majority, you know, it doesn't stop the rhetoric. And unfortunately, it's the rhetoric that gets to the heart and soul of especially some of our younger transgender people. And quite frankly, it's not something that we should ever stand for or allow to be said without a counter, without a response, which is that's not a, Colorado's not a place for that type of hatred, and that we're going to stand up and not only represent LGBTQ people, but support and protect LGBTQ folks, especially trans folks, as much as we can at all costs.
And I think that is always a tough stance to take in a bipartisan atmosphere that is at times very divisive.
Absolutely.
Hard to keep your cool when the rhetoric is blowing around everywhere, and it must just make you grit your teeth. I'm sure, you know, sometimes you hear things from your own constituents that's painful or hurtful.
Yeah, absolutely. We do. But I gotta say, the positivity really does outweigh the negativity. And so that's something that keeps me going in my work. And just knowing that kind of that hatred or that backlash is coming because of our effectiveness, right? Because we've been able to do such great things in Colorado and support our transgender folks, our Black community, our BIPOC, whomever. In ways that we just hadn't been able to in the past or hadn't done so in the past. And so knowing that backlash is coming because of progress gives me hope and pushes me forward.
If anyone could look at some of the bills that you passed just this session, and I know you can look at each session, you are layering on approaches to systemic change. You're a good model for showing how do you slowly nibble and bite away at that oppression in a system, because people can feel hopeless. And what fuels you to be able to see it and identify it and do it?
You know, it's really listening to my constituents and the people of Colorado. Their direct experience makes a difference. And so when folks talk to me about criminal justice reform or their juvenile fines and fees, for instance, and then knowing that I go and pass a bill, you know, that will wipe away all fines and fees for juveniles and moving forward, knowing that that's going to have impact on hundreds of thousands of people, that fuels me, you know. You know, when I heard stories of hair discrimination from our young people, and seeing the hurt that they felt, knowing that I felt that same hurt when I had the same experiences, but knowing that I can do something about it now. And I passed the Crown Act last year that says that you can no longer discriminate based on ethnic hairstyles. You know, so knowing that I can make those changes and not only, you know, listen to my constituents' concerns, but then take what I've learned from them and make real change in Colorado has been extremely empowering. And, you know, I look at it because I do feel like there's a window, right? There's a window of opportunity for true progress to happen. And I have been blessed to be a part of a body that can make change during that window. And so whether it's with the additional funding coming in for the budget or the appetite for criminal justice reform in our communities and the calls for, you know, racial justice, I'm able to be here at a time when I can make change. And that's what I'm gonna do, you know? For as long as this window is open, I'm going to continue to push hard and boldly on issues that will have a real impact on Coloradans' lives.
Some people in the political sphere would play it much safer than you do. You know, picking topics that are less hot, you know, criminal justice, for example, is a fairly hot topic. Of course, anything around racial justice is considered a hot topic in terms of polarizing at this point. And a lot of people would just pick something, pick things that are, you know, you can safely do, but correct and take care of your political future. But you don't seem to have done that.
No, you know, I do feel like maybe because they had to or because they just didn't want to, you know, the safe path forward has not gotten us where we need to be. You know, the fact that we're sitting here in 2021 and still talking about police accountability or still talking about, you know, racial justice, it's frustrating and it blows my mind. And I know that that's why so many people don't believe in any party system or don't believe that progress can be made at all, you know? And I believe that it is my job and the job of my colleagues, especially those of us in the Black Caucus, we have that extra burden of trying to bring hope to a community that has the right to be hopeless, you know? And that's kind of what we try to work on. And that's what, again, really does push me forward. I mean, the fact that I could easily take a simple route forward, or always look to the next seat and seeing if this would be the right move to win my next election. You know, I mean, that is, I believe, I'm just going to be honest with you. I believe that's upholding white supremacy, because what you're trying to do is keep your power at the expense of those who are powerless. And I just refuse to be that way. And quite frankly, you know, if my boldness, if people lose appetite for my boldness or the work that I'm doing, and they decide not to vote for me again, then that's okay. You know, then my time has run its course, and I will go do something else, and that's fine. But at least we'll have made change, real change.
Yeah, that you can feel like the time you spent was worth it to you, because it you know, it costs politicians a lot. Actually, I personally think you give a lot. It's not just your time. I mean, I don't know how you all do it. It's looks like a painful position to be in, because you're in a tug of war among lots of different people.
Yeah, absolutely. At times it can feel that way, because that is true. We are at a tug of war, and I think a lot of the kind of benefits or whatnot that folks think that we receive, we just quite frankly don't. And so you have to be in it for something, you know? And for me, it is this change. And unfortunately, there are those who are in it for the wrong reasons, but you know, that's them, you know, and I don't think that's the way that we all need to be. It's my hope that when I do leave office, that I have inspired someone else to run, who will take that same bold approach.
When you look at some of the changes you've been able to make in criminal justice, you know, where do you think we are, and where do we need to go next?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I think we've made a lot of progress, you know, whether it's, you know, decriminalizing simple possession of drugs, or looking at the police reform that we've been able to do. We in Colorado have been able to make huge strides when it comes to criminal justice reform. But the system is just built up in a way that's so problematic for people who are caught up in it, whether you're a person of color or low-income person or a queer person. I mean, it's really set up in a way that you fail. And so we've got to continue to look at what isn't working in the system, and really make sure that it's just. And, you know, I don't necessarily believe we need to blow up the entire system, but what I do think is that we need to continue to pull the bricks of injustice out of the system, because they are the foundation. And so we do have to change that and replace it with something that actually works for our community. So for me, it's looking at, what are we doing on mental health? You know, are we making sure that people have access to jobs and education and mental health care so that they can really thrive and build that intergenerational wealth and resilience that we should have in our communities? You know, that really should be our focus, not just incarceration. And so alongside of my criminal justice work, I'm proud to have been able to pass a ballot measure here in Denver called Caring for Denver, which has created the largest mental health foundation in the state that I'm now the chair of, and able to really give funding back into the community in a way that's truly innovative and bold, but that will also help get people on the right path, you know? That's really what we're trying to do here. So it's not just saying that people should be able to, you know, commit a crime with no responsibility, but it is saying, what is our responsibility as a society and as a system to make sure that that person next succeeds, or that person never gets in the system in the first place? So that's what I'm working on, and that's my approach.
Changing the system that's embedded in inequity, whether it is white supremacy or fiscal injustice from multiple ways, it seems like there's a lot of misunderstanding and fear floating around in our country. What are some of the things you think people misunderstand about criminal justice reform?
I think that people have come a long way and really do understand why reform is necessary. There was a poll that was put out last year after we passed our police reform efforts, and 70% of Coloradans said it was the right thing to do. That's huge. You know, I think people really understand it. But the misconceptions still are around this, like, you know, that you have to decide whether or not you want public safety or criminal justice reform. And that's just not true. You know, quite frankly, our system is failing us so much so that we have people who recidivate at such high rates, which means they come back out of jail and commit more crimes because they have no other options, you know? And you can't feed your family or yourself, or you can't get a job, or you're in a halfway house that doesn't value as a human being. Like, you commit more crimes, and we have created a system that does that. In fact, Colorado has one of the highest recidivism rates in the nation. I don't think of Colorado as an unsafe place, but that's the truth, you know? And so what are we doing to make sure that our system of rehabilitation really is rehabilitation? And so I think that there's a balance, and that people have to balance themselves about this, like, oh, it's criminal justice reform or it's public safety. No, criminal justice reform is public safety, right? And it is building up our communities. And so once we start thinking of it that way, I think we have a lot more common ground than we do division.
If you're just joining us, I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. This is Outsources, and we're talking with Colorado State Representative Leslie Harrod. You know, when you look at some of the other things floating around right now that are difficult, one of the latest things being tossed out there is looking at critical race theory, which most people don't seem to even know what they're talking about, how it's being used to really be a wedge issue or a code for anything that that smacks of saying we don't have a perfect system, meaning a perfect system for white people. But could you speak to that just a bit about what you see going on and your thoughts?
Yeah, again, I think this is part of that backlash, you know, about the racial reckoning. But really, I think stems from the conversation that the New York Times put out, the 1619 Project, I think it's called. And that was a real wake-up call for many folks who listen. I mean, I learned things in listening to that podcast and really walking through that journey with the New York Times. And I thought it was so very impactful. And it has really influenced policy. I gotta be honest with you. There are many of us who have listened to some of those episodes and been like, oh, we gotta do more for Black farmers. Or I didn't realize that this is, you know, kind of, you know, how the monument conversation has developed in, say, Virginia or whatever that was. And so thinking about things through a critical race lens has been something that folks in ethnic studies courses have learned, but it hasn't been put into our history books. And I think that's a disservice, you know, the fact that we didn't know that the founding of Colorado can be thanked. You know, we should thank a Black man for that, and Barney Ford, and how he said, you know, we're not going to make Colorado a state until Black men have the right to vote. You know, we don't hear about that. And in most photos in our history books of Barney Ford, he looks white, you know? And so it's fascinating how we've been able to whitewash or even just homogenize our history in a way that depreciates the value of Black people and other BIPOC people. And I think that's a problem. And so now that we've kind of been going on this journey, folks are saying, well, let's change the books, right? Or let's have a conversation that is more authentic and real to how our country really has been founded and who we really are. And that's something that folks just don't want to do, and there's backlash against that, you know? They feel like because we're talking about racism, that we are then saying that they are the problem and that they are racist and that they need to, you know, pay reparations or whatnot. And that's just not the case, although some of these folks very much are racist and they don't want to have those conversations. But really, we haven't embraced or taught folks that it's okay to be uncomfortable when we're talking about things like critical race theory or just race in general. LGBTQ issues, we should be uncomfortable, you know? We have an uncomfortable past. We have tragic past. We have something that some folks don't want to look at all, but we've got to face it in order to move through it. And that's what critical race theory does. But when we're talking about it in schools, it's so fascinating. I don't know what they think we're trying to teach our young people, you know, other than the fact that people of color exist and have contributions. But it's really just teaching the honest truth about history, but it's not forcing some theory down someone's throat. It is just history, and told from all of the perspectives that make up U.S. American history. And so I don't understand the backlash of wanting to hear the truth, other than don't want to acknowledge the impact that racism has had on this country, but we have to.
I'm looking at the way it's systemically been built into our country's fabric in ways that probably each of us would be surprised to know, no matter who we are. You as a leader, you know, how did you get interested in politics and leadership, and how do you trace that? I think you were born in Germany, and your mother was an officer in the Army, U.S. Army Nurse Corps. And
yeah.
I always think that being a military dependent always has implications for people, good and bad. How would you trace your interest in leadership, taking on politics and tough things?
Yeah, well, I'll say and for me, it's good. My brother might have a different perspective, but I love being able to travel and see different perspectives, different communities from a very young age, and not realize that different is bad, or not feel like different is bad in any way, but just thinking difference is to be celebrated, and remembering that I got to try new foods and learn new dances and new outfits and clothes and excitement. I mean, it was just a real eye-opener for me as a child. And so when I look at things now, I'm like, well, things actually don't have to be one way. You know, they're doing it differently here or there or here. And we should take some of those lessons and learnings and try some things differently, you know? But when it comes to how I started in this work as I guess a leader or politics, I think I kind of always had it in me. You know, I will say I was captain of the cheerleading squad, and I was on every single like club and sport that I possibly could be, because really how I made friends moving from school to school, you know? And so that just gave me this desire to always want to know what's going on in a new or unique community, or in the community in general. And then when I went to CU Boulder for college, the University of Colorado at Boulder, I thought I was going to cheer and to you know, maybe be a sociologist or something like that. And instead realized that the campus needed leadership when it came to to students of color and progressives, and that we didn't have representation. And so, you know, I quit cheering and I started to work in student government. I ran for office, I won. Didn't realize we had the largest student government in the nation. So ended up being president and running a $36 million budget by the time I was like 20, and making great friends along the way. And so that really got the bug in me, knowing that we could make change through legislation. And we did. And so I never really lost that bug, and just kept working in politics and in policy my entire career. And well, here I am now.
What thoughts do you have about how we're going to heal some of the big divisiveness in our communities that are floating around in a toxic way right now?
Yeah, I think we just have to sit down together and have conversation. You know, and I don't necessarily mean with conversation with people who don't want to talk, you know, but it's everyone else. You know, the vitriol and the hatred that's coming from some is a real small percentage. We have to keep that in mind. But the silence is almost as problematic. And so we've got to start having conversation with folks who maybe are afraid or shy to talk about these really tough issues, and to talk through it together as a community, as a society. That's how we're going to get through that, you know? And so, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot recently, and thinking about kind of coming back. And now that we can come out of the house a little bit more, or maybe not, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Right.
But just trying to have some of these conversations together with people who are not like-minded, because I think with COVID, we've been able to surround ourselves with just our friends, just our families, just our bubble. And that's been, I think, a safe place, but it might be time for us to come back out and have these conversations with folks who don't look like us or think like us, just a little bit, so that we can work together to rebuild our society.
As a leader, how have you been able to take care of yourself and make sure you have fun and rest and healing time? You know, what are, and maybe it's a little bit of advice to those who aspire to leadership positions, you know, how do you take care of yourself and keep your own center?
Well, I got to tell you, I think I've pretended to be good at this for a long time, and I have not been very good at that at all. I focus on work and on, you know, just community and things that we can get done so much that I forget to take the time for myself. So for me, I love the arts. I love being exposed to the arts. And if I feel like I have to work, fine, make it art, you know? And so I become the chair of the art caucus because at least I can take reprieve in like going to a show or speaking to cultural leaders, you know, who can think of things a different way, you know, who can stretch my creativity and my innovation. And so I really think that we all should do something creative. Now, I am no artist. I can't sing. I can't dance. I can't paint, but I can appreciate the arts, and that's something that I love to do. But on top of that, I have been so blessed with friends who really value who I am as a person and not just as a title. And they have been keenly aware of the fact that I do not do self-care well and have started to kind of gang up on me in a way and make sure that I am taking that time for myself and just breathing, relaxing, or hanging out with friends who want nothing from me. And I think as leaders, we've got to take the time to do that and to build those relationships.
Mm-hmm. In our last moment here, do you have anything else you want to make sure that our listeners hear from you about, or just last words?
Yeah, I think a lot of us are tired. You know, we have dealt with a pandemic, you know, dealing with a pandemic, we're dealing with this racial reckoning, we're dealing with so much going on in society that we're tired and we want to retreat. But now is not the time. We might do things a little differently, but we still have to engage. Don't shut down. Don't close up. Get out there in your own way and continue to do the work, because as painful as it might seem, we have been making such progress. And I believe that we're going to look back on this time and say, wow, this was a real turning point in our society. And what I want to make sure is that we turn the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Representative Herod. We really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you for your thoughts and insight and advice on our show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Colorado State Representative on Outsources. If you missed any part of this interview, I recommend you go back and listen to news.kgnu.org/outsources on our news blog, or just look up the main site on kgnu.org and look for Outsources. You can tune in every Monday evening at 6:30 and hear about a different topic each time, all around the LGBTQ issues of importance to all of us. Take care of your blessings. This is your host, Karen Rayforth.